Welcome to People, Places, and How We Use Spaces, where we chat with amazing, successful people whose stories inspire us. As a bonus, all of our guests have something to teach us about commercial real estate based on their own experiences. I am your host, Lisa Christensen. My companies help business owners, developers, and investors buy, sell, and lease space. On today's episode of People and Places and How We Use Spaces, I am joined by my guests, Matt Hazelton and Corey Villiam. Corey and Matt are Senior Directors of Capital Markets at JLL. You'll get to know Matt and Corey a little bit better listening to our discussion. You'll also learn how ignorance was bliss when they got into the industry, not knowing much about the brokerage world. And now they're the pros in our market. They will share some of their experiences and give us insight into where the capital markets sit today, especially as it relates to retail. Before we get started, I'd like to thank you all for taking the time to listen. I'd really appreciate it if you would follow, subscribe, share, rate, and review the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'd also like to invite you to join me for lunch. Help me serve lunch to the little ones at the Minneapolis Crisis Nursery and or join our $100 lunch club. A link to the signups with additional details will be found in the show notes. And now I'd like to give a warm welcome to Matt Hazelton and Corey Villiam. Corey and Matt, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
It's so good to see you. And it's just always fun to continue to get to know other brokers in the business. And I think we're lucky in Minnesota that we have a brokerage community that is kind of friends more than we are competitors, right? So thanks for joining me. I'm excited to learn a little bit more about you guys. You're both like Minnesota boys, right?
Yep. Born and raised.
And you're a team. Is that right? Are you the team, the two of you?
We're partners.
Partners. Okay.
Yeah, we're a team.
Partners.
I tell everyone he knows me better than my wife does.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. And tell me what you do. Where are you now and what are you working on? I know your title, but what do you actually do?
So our team, we head up the retail capital markets arm of JLL Minneapolis. So our business is shopping centers, single tenant buildings, larger shopping centers. We kind of categorize into those three tranches.
Selling them.
So we're pretty much just in the sales game.
Got it.
As opposed to, you know, leasing and.
Are you representing both buyers and sellers or more so sellers?
I would say more so sellers.
Okay.
We work with buyers on a kind of selective basis, but mostly sellers.
Got it. And you guys have been partners for a long time, right?
Yeah. So we've been in a partnership for like 10 years now. But we worked alongside each other for a while before that, you know, kind of independently.
Years.
Yeah.
We started in the business weeks apart.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Corey, how did you get started in this business and why commercial real estate? Like, what were you thinking?
It was an accident. my stepdad, Tom Lohman, was a developer. My real dad is an attorney by trade, and I was going to be an attorney. I was pre-law when I went to college. And then I got through about 3 years of school and decided I didn't want to do any more school. So my stepdad told me, just get out with a degree. And I went to St. Thomas, so there's a lot of real estate guys there. And I got an internship at United Properties back when it was still UP on an industrial leasing team. And I never really liked leasing that much, but I liked the business. And so seeing him do development and, you know, I had big dreams to be a developer. And he told me to get into investment sales if I could. And at that time, Marcus Millichap was just opening an office in the Twin Cities, and you know, I didn't know anything. So I applied and I got a job there and started 2 weeks after I graduated. And here I am almost 20 years later. So it was kind of an accident.
Interesting. Yeah. And it's interesting when it's kind of in the family, it's hard to turn your back on it, I think, a little bit. Kind of gets in your blood a little.
Yeah, I don't know that I would tell my daughter to do it, but it's been a good career. It's just you know. There's a lot of ups and downs.
That's for sure.
We've gone through some pretty fun cycles in those 18 years.
Yes, fun.
Fun. Yes, we have a twisted way of having a good time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Matt, how did you get into this crazy business?
I had no family ties. My parents are from Miami, Florida, but
really?
And moved to Minnesota when I was like 6 months old, 2 years old, somewhere there. I grew up in Cannon Falls. So not, you know, really part of the metro. When I was coming out of college, I didn't really know what to do. I was interviewing everywhere. I interviewed to be a factory manager at Pella Windows.
And what was your major, Matt?
Back up, I graduated with a music major from Luther College.
Like what kind of music?
I played in the orchestra. And
what instrument?
Bass.
Nice.
So yeah, so I joked that I took the normal route into real estate. About kind of two thirds of the way through college, I kind of had the look in the mirror moment of like, oh man, what am I going to do? Like this, I had an idea. It didn't feel like that was going to pan out. And then just thought, hey, I'll just cram in as many finance courses as I can. And hopefully I'll figure it out later.
What was your original plan?
Yeah, my original plan, I wanted to be an orchestra director at a college.
Nice. So
that was like at a high school and then college. And I had some friends that, you know, were student teaching, came back, and I still think it's an awesome, awesome career. I kind of looked at it though. I was like, man, I just don't think that's for me. So again, I kind of pivoted a little within college. And as I got out of school, like I said, it was just interviewing all over the place. I was getting kind of discouraged. And my dad told me, he said, you know what? He's like, I got this high school friend from back in Florida. He lives down in Dallas now. He's like, I don't know what he does, but I think he makes a lot of money. So he's like, you should just give him a call. Just kind of like, you know, informational interview. Just call him up, see what's up. And so I called him up. Turns out he worked for Marcus and Millichap in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, funny.
And
what's his name?
His name was Howard First.
Okay.
He has since passed away actually in the last few years, but great dude. He told me at the time, he's like, hey, you know, if you're interested in this, he's like, Marcus Millichap's actually opening an office in Minneapolis, like right now. And he's like, if you want to throw your resume through, I'll talk to the managers and see if we can get you an interview. And so he did. I mean, I got an interview and I got hired, in quotes, hired.
Yeah, right. Here's a desk.
Here's a desk and a phone, and pay us your money so that you can go through our training program and make sure to bring your own computer.
At the time, we didn't know. I remember I went to the first like informational meeting. I went home and told my parents, like, there's no way I can get a job at this place. Well, come to find out, after being there for quite a while and seeing 200 people come and go, you really, as much as I hate to say it, just need to be able to fog a mirror. And so
Yeah. I should add though, like, I mean, it ended up being a great experience for the two of us. I mean, I don't think we'd be where we are today without having started there, because it certainly, you know, a music major from Luther College with zero family ties to the real estate industry locally. I wasn't getting a job at Welsh. I wasn't getting a job at UP. I wasn't getting a job at CB. Like, I wouldn't get a call back from any of those at the time. And you know what? Here we are now. We work at JLL and it's, you know, it's going okay.
Yeah. And really that Marcus and Millichap training ground, I mean, they do hire a lot of people because not very many people can figure it out. How'd you guys figure it out?
Trial and error.
A lot of mistakes.
Funny story, like, you know, just the way to get going there. I mean, you really, like we just said earlier, you're set up with a desk and a phone and a computer to go database and figure out who to talk to. When I started, the first desk I got sat at was right next to Corey.
We were at a table. We were in temp space.
Smaller than this table right here.
Oh my God.
Facing the wall.
Yeah.
And facing the wall. Yeah,
and there was at any given time, because people would come and go, I don't know how many people we had in that room, 15? Yeah. I mean, it was like boiler room, but you know, it was temp space while they built out our new space at Normandale Lakes. And the one thing that he was saying is their training was really good in terms of like, I mean, I'll be honest, when I started there, I didn't know what a cap rate was. I mean, I'd done some leasing, but not anything in the capital markets world. And they just put you kind of on a 3-month fast track training program. And the whole time you're out databasing buildings. And mind you, this was before CoStar wasn't in Minneapolis yet, so we couldn't look on CoStar. There was no, LoopNet was in its like infancy stages. So we had really to go build this ourselves. And they just said, here's some training and a phone. And then they said, you know, you got to go make 300 calls a week. And that's what we did. And how did we do it? We made a lot of mistakes. I mean, there was no mentorship. We had a regional manager that was great, but he was spread thin because he was trying to grow the office. And so I remember calling gas stations and, you know, wasted so much time. But
I cold called Corey's stepdad at his house, and Corey's sister answered the phone
and thought it was me. Because Marcus Millichap came up on
the caller ID on the landline.
And I was sitting next to Matt and he's like, no. this is Matt. And I looked over and what the heck is going on? He's like, I don't know. And it turns out he called, my stepdad was part of an ownership group that owned a not so nice office building in Burnsville. And so Matt just got my parents' phone number and called him at home. And my sister answered.
My initial area that, you know, Marcus was all about territories and where you were focused on. And my territory and product type was office buildings in Dakota County.
Oh, nice.
So tough product to work without a leasing arm.
Yeah.
And certainly without a senior, you know, person to kind of shadow under. So it was nobody leading the blind.
Right. I mean, I kind of did the same thing. I worked at Griffin for a little while and I was charged with selling apartment buildings. And I literally just figured out, I don't even know how, because computers were like almost non-existent. And like, I just figured out who all these owners were. I think I looked at, you know, books and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just tried to meet with as many apartment building owners as I could. And I mean, it was, you know, the first couple sales were interesting buildings, shall we say.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was 22, I looked like I was 16.
Well, cause you look like you're 22 now.
Yeah. I don't feel like that. I would wear glasses in meetings. I would
to try to look.
Well, sure. Because you know, you're cold calling these groups and they don't know you from Adam. Right. And so you go in there and here they've got these, you know, in some cases, this private capital stuff, this is these people's life savings. And these are big investments. And there's this 22-year-old punk that comes through the door like, oh, I could sell this for you, no problem. And try telling them what they should and shouldn't do with their investments. And the glasses helped a little bit, but it was tough going there for a while.
Do you guys remember the first sale?
I do.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. My first sale was the Econo Foods in Norwood Young America.
Really?
So, yeah. I mean,
not office and not to go.
Yeah. Right. I repped a buyer into it and I was like, oh man, this is interesting. People actually want to buy this. And nobody wants to buy or sell any of these office buildings that I'm talking about down in Dakota County. But this single tenant grocery store backed by a credit tenant, because it was a Nash Finch at the time before they had sold to Spartan or merged with Spartan. But they knew there were multiple bids on it. So that kind of was the catalyst for me. To jump into retail.
Sure.
And because I looked at what, you know, I knew there were multiple bids on the property in addition to the buyer that I was representing. And I said, oh, okay. So people actually want to buy this. Maybe I should try to sell this stuff. And so that was the jumping point where I started looking more at like single tenant retail and other just different facets of retail.
That's interesting. So Corey, what was your first sale?
Rockwoods Barn Grill in Otsego. Sale lease back. And it was big. It was like 20, it's still there. 20-ish, 1,000 square feet. We did a sale lease back. Everybody laughed at me. There's like, but you got to remember, we started in 06 and things were nuts. And we didn't know that. We just thought that was normal. And even into 2007, when the housing market started to tank, we were still selling deals with cap rates that were at the time historically low. And so I got this Rockwood sale lease back deal and I was bound and determined I was going to sell it. And I ended up finding a buyer, a local buyer, and we closed the deal. So this isn't funny, but Rockwoods made 3 rent payments and then quit. So he ended up buying or taking the business, and Rockwoods is still there. And I think he still owns it. That was in 2007. And oddly enough, the buyer financed that with Tony Carlson, who was at Granbridge, now at Colliers. So it was his first transaction on the debt side. My first transaction, he's light years ahead of me in the business and doing great. And then it was a couple of clients after the fact were like, I didn't have the heart to tell you, kid, but I didn't think there was a chance in hell you were going to sell that. And even my stepdad told me, he's like, yeah, you told me about it. And I tried to act excited, but I didn't think there was a chance in hell. And somehow I got it done. So I don't know, luck.
Yeah, luck. But what little I know about you, there's a drive inside of you that's pretty insatiable.
Yeah, I don't know. It's probably the only thing that's got me to where I'm at. I love the competition. So as much as we're all friends here, that's what keeps me going. I don't like losing. And it was one of those things when I got out of college at St. Thomas, everybody was going to Best Buy and General Mills, and they were all coming to campus to take kids out to dinner and all this. And I just wanted no part of that. And I was like, no, I'm going to go do something stupid. And And so I had like a chip on my shoulder. I had to prove all of them wrong. And that's kind of what drove me. So I just worked and we worked a lot. And then 2008 happened.
Right. Right. So you got a little of the good. Then you went through that was a really tough period.
Yeah. It seemed easy. Right. I mean, relatively speaking, I mean, it wasn't easy, but when we were doing it that, like we were seeing all the other brokers inside of Marcus. And back then Marcus really did have a proprietary system. Like we had LoopNet, but inside of Marcus. So outside brokers, I mean, we were doing deals. We were bringing money into the, you know, crossing state lines kind of before the rest of the market did it, LoopNet. And so it was almost not like shooting fish in a barrel, but we saw all these guys in other markets making just a killing. And then I think we all kind of got a taste of it. I know I did. And cause I was out earning my friends right away. And then when the recession hit, they're like, you got to quit. Like, you got to just be done. And I'm like, no, cause you get a taste of it. And like, I'm not, there's runway. Well, and then we suffered for
a long time.
So Matt, what did you guys decide to leave Marcus at the same time? Or what was the impetus for moving on to the next?
So, you know, I think a lot of people at Marcus, there's many people that stay at Marcus for a really long time. I mean, you know, any company, you have the people that stick at a company for a really long time. For us, just, you know, the decisions, I think, to move from company to company are pretty local. There's no like macro, factors there. We just looked and saw, hey, there's a hole over at CBRE. They had called us to, you know, come over, and we moved over there as part of a larger team. And then while there was another hole that opened up, JLL called us and said, hey, we want somebody to run our retail capital markets, and said, would you guys like to do it? And we said, yeah, sounds like a good fit. So, you know, we just thought that it was probably a better fit for us.
Yeah.
And you don't, as you grow up and as you keep going in your business and your career, you evolve, right? And at Marcus, we were kind of pigeonholed into strictly private capital deals, you know, kind of call it under, I think our biggest one there was maybe 18 million, but that was kind of a outlier. And I think our average deal there was four million. And, you know, you start looking as you get into the business a long time and you start looking at the landscape and who's doing what. And you got to pick up some of the big trades, and we just didn't really have the opportunity there. And so when CB called, obviously they're the machine, right? So we went there and didn't do any real big deals there, but we did some fun deals there. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as then COVID happened and JLL, big part for us is the leasing team. And we kind of knew JLL was going to have a hole because they went out and got Ted Gonsier and his team. And so they called us, and the way that they approached the business is more of like a national, one big national team, played well for me and Matt. So it just made sense. And we love it over there so far. Been 2 years now.
So you talk about fun deals that you did. Matt, can you think of any deal that was super fun to work on? Like, is there any that stand out?
Well, I guess the first fun one, I mean, Corey can kind of touch on this, but the first fun one we did was probably at 50th in France. That was like the first like big deal, where like bigger deal that we worked on and had solid interest. It was, you know, notable, all that stuff.
They're all fun when you have a buyer sheet 10 bids deep.
Well, there you go.
Pinehurst was fun though. So that was my stepdad's deal that he had developed for Anthropology.
Yep.
He made us compete for the listing, and we got the listing, and there was a lot, I'm not going to say names, but there were three or four people on that bid sheet that we did that deal on 16.
I think so, yeah.
So 10 years, I'd been calling and calling and calling them with no response. And then all of a sudden we took out that listing and they were my best friend. So that was kind of fun just because it was like, now you like me. But we had, I think, 12 bids on that deal, and we went way over our pricing. We thought we were going to, I think we told them high end was 17 and we hit 18. We worked with apartment guys on that. They brought an apartment buyer to the deal. He went, you know, the terms were unbelievable. So that was fun.
You know, the other fun ones that we work on now, I think are more, I mean, for me, are kind of on the development side. We're kind of coaching some of these developers like through the early stages of the continuum, where, you know, they'll call call us up and say, hey, what do you think of this tenant? You know, what kind of terms do they typically do? You know, what's the exit look like? And, you know, so we'll kind of coach on the front end from exit strategy.
Sure.
And then, so it's fun because you start with that. And then now we've been through the whole continuum, you know, multiple times on some of these deals where you get to see the whole thing through. You know, you talk about it in the early stages, you see them get it built, and then you help them with the exit and it sells. And even so now we're actually seeing it the second go around where like the person that we ended up selling it to, we've listed it for them, you know, kind of a second generation deal.
Yeah. It's fun when you get that again. You know, we just listed a property and we sold it to them in 16, I think. And it's fun to it's a lot easier the second time.
Right? Yeah.
So, and to have those relationships continue with you and had a relationship with the seller and then having a great relationship with the buyer, something went right there that you kind of did right by both people. And then to have that buyer come to you and say, hey, now I want to be a seller.
I mean, it's like the ultimate like validation of like what you're doing. You know, when it comes back, when a deal comes back around, it means, hey, you did a pretty good job the first time around.
Right.
And I think that's something, this kind of speaks to like the way we've tried to operate now. I think we haven't always operated this way, but you know, really try to not take a transactional approach, you know, take a more consultative, like advisory role in things. Like, you know, sometimes we end a pitch meeting where we'll say, I don't think you should sell. You know, it's not the right time. You should, you know, wait X number of months or years or, you know, depending on what's going on. But there was, you know, the early days, it's just pounded into you like sell, 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 you know, go chase the paycheck. And like, if you don't have any inventory, you're not making any money. So get out there. And I think that that's different than some other markets, but I think it's worked well for us.
The other one that was really fun was the Melzer block in Northeast Minneapolis. You know that one?
I don't.
It's what? Noodles
to Masu?
All the way to Masu. There's eight or 10 buildings. I don't know. The Melzer family had acquired and pieced this thing together since the 40s, and the patriarch passed away and his son was selling it. So we had that deal under contract going into COVID. Asana Partners bought it, but that one was fun. It was hard because it was
nail-biter.
Old and and it was a nightmare to underwrite. And you know, you're piecemealing 10 buildings together. And
you sold them as a package.
Yeah, we underwrote it all as one deal. It had to go basically as one deal.
It's three parcels, but like
10 parcels,
buildings.
10 buildings, historic components. So it wasn't really a redevelopment. And Martha Anderson, shout out to her, did an awesome job of managing that deal. So it made it easier. But we sold it to Asana. And do you remember during the riots when Mayor Fry lives in the building or did during the riots when he went outside of his house and all the people were on the street yelling at him and stuff? Well, we hadn't closed yet. So the guys down in North Carolina saw that. They're like, hey, we saw Melzer on the news today. I was like, oh man, COVID, so, right?
We didn't have, still going to close?
Yeah.
Cool. Like,
we had seven deals drop first 5 days of COVID and this one hung on. So we're like, we really need this one. But that one was fun because that one was a little different.
Yeah, it's fun when you can kind of crack the nut a little bit, like, and it's not just a super easy slam dunk thing. Well, you've been through a variety of cycles. How would you classify the market today?
I would say that based on transaction velocity and the general sentiment where we're at, I mean, it's not as bad as 2008, but it's feeling more like that than like, I mean, I guess that's the only real downturn we have to compare it to that we've actually been through.
I think it depends on who you ask. From a investment, sale, capital market, broker perspective, it's downright awful. Velocity was down, I think, in commercial real estate, sales were down 60% last year in 23. I think everybody kind of is holding out hope the Fed does something in the second half of this year, and who knows what they'll do. But from a retail owner perspective,
fundamentals of retail.
I mean, it's, and that's a big contrast to 08 when the capital markets were on, you know, fell on their face, and so did the fundamentals of the underlying real estate. The difference this time around is we're at the best occupancy rates we've ever seen. So historically low occupancy. We're losing retail space every year. 1% of retail space is being demolished, mainly big malls. Rents are finally going up. You can't build it because it's too expensive and tenants can't pay for it. So the operators and the owners of this real estate, these retail properties, are cash flowing like crazy, and they're having fights over big box vacancies where going into COVID, we thought that stuff was just dead.
Big box was a four letter word.
Big box now is like, you know, they lose a Bed Bath, they get four bids from, you know, Nordstrom type tenants. And so the operation side is excellent, where I think there's going to start, and there's no distress. So no distress and no velocity. And so being an investment sale broker is tough right now, but I think that's going to change coming into 25, 6 and 27, because everybody refinanced or put new debt on these buildings in 2020, 21 and 22. And we talked to most people about their debt situation. And I can say there's only one group in the Twin Cities that I know of that did 10-year money on everything. So everybody's going to have to start making decisions starting in the back half of 25. And, you know, they finance these things that we saw it when we were selling all that stuff in 21 and 22, the interest rates were, you know, call it 3.5%,
right?
20% down. And those numbers don't work anymore. So I don't think we're going to see real pain, but I think there's going to be a lot of conversations about
it. It drives like there, a decision has to be made.
Something has to happen.
You know, something has to happen.
And that's all we need in our business, right? There needs to be some kind of event or something that creates motivation to not just stay the course.
Exactly. Right. If everything is going great, well then, you know, just keep going as is. You don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
So just like every other downturn, there's a little light at the end of the tunnel that keeps you getting out of bed every morning
and keeps engaged,
going to the office. But everybody I talk to that's not in the business is like, oh man, it must be horrible. It's like, kind of for sales, it's not great. I mean, we're
clipping off deals.
We're getting stuff. I don't know how many we did last year, 15 or something like that. We're getting deals done. Most of the stuff we sold in 23 was partnership breakup stuff. So properties that have been handed down to siblings and the four siblings or five siblings or however many people just want to go their own way. So they just say, you know what? We know we're not topping the market right now. That's fine. We just want the money. We did quite a few of those last year. Most of them have an underlying circumstance to go to market. Now there's a couple last year that were just like, you know, we just want to sell. But, you know, if you own a retail center and I come to you and say, hey, Lisa, values are down and there's nothing to exchange into, you're probably going to say, well, I'm full cash flowing like crazy and I'm probably not going to do anything. And I don't blame you. So everything else, it'll come back.
Conversely, with 2021 and 2022, you know, you could call anybody up and say, hey, would you take an unbelievable number on your building today? And it's like, well, yeah, sure. And, you know, 8 times out of 10, you could deliver that. You know, you're not doing that in 23. You know, there's no anybody who was solely price motivated before. Like, that's just off the table. You don't have to do anything.
You probably know this, but this needed to happen.
Right. It really did.
I mean, it was too crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And
I liked too crazy, but
I did too. But but at the same time, there was a lot of really dumb things getting done. And, you know,
I mean, I think that's true right before any, you know, people just don't, they lose track of the fundamentals and they just get a little bit, I don't know. It's human nature, I think. But
and just buying anything and watching it go up, nobody could make any mistakes. And that's not all bad, but this is a business where these people on the ownership and operating side are generally, they're pros, right? And we saw a lot of not pros get in and make a lot of money, and that's great, and I'm happy for all of them. But
yeah, any problems were solved just by the market.
It didn't matter.
You know?
So, and then we had, you know, on a competition scale, on the competition side, you know, our biggest competitors over the last 3 years weren't the usual guys like Bob Pounds and the pros. It was these kind of residential realtors that would just cold call and I got a buyer. And
the point, would you take an unbelievable number on your property today?
And the answer is yes.
Absolutely.
And so that's frustrating. And, you know, because we've kind of built our business on, you asked about sellers and buyers. I mean, we don't work buy side very hard at all. We just want to control inventory and we're, you know, so anyways, it needed to happen. And be careful what you wish for, because now we're
right.
But It'll come back.
Who are the buyers today? How do deals pencil?
Cash.
Yeah.
You wanna- so we found that the ones that, you know, where you top value, I mean, the term we throw out is you find the unicorn buyer, you know, the perfect scenario. We just closed on a center around a month ago, a little more, and the buyer was in a 1031 exchange. It was a deal in Madison, Wisconsin. They had sold a farm in Utah for all cash, and they had a son that went to UW Law and was going to stay and practice law in Madison. So they said, hey, we want to buy a shopping center in Madison. Well, fortunately, we had the only one on the market at the time that was in the price point that fit what they were looking to do. So they bought it and they paid the best price. We ended up having, I think, 6 or 7 bids on the property. They were the top one, and they paid all cash for it. And it worked. You know, 4 months earlier, we sold the center, basically the same story, all cash, 1031 buyer, you know, but those buyers that are out there, that profile is just not as prevalent. You know, that if there were, you know, if you got 10 back in 21 and early 22, if you got 10 bids, 6 of them would be from exchange buyers.
And good.
And solid. Today, if you get 5 bids, hopefully one of them is from an exchange buyer. You know, these are just not as out there today. You get a mix of kind of regional groups buying. There's kind of the local folks, or I guess local to regional folks that, you know, are kind of always buying and selling. I think the most interesting new entry to the market is the funds out there that are now chasing the retail space. I think in the hunt for yield, retail looks pretty good. You know, retail,
is crazy, right? Because I mean, a few years ago, it wasn't that long ago where I just remember lenders wouldn't touch retail.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a dirty word.
Yeah. There's more money, and this is awesome for us because this has never been this way, but there's more money chasing unanchored strips. And I'm not talking grocery anchored, and I'm not talking like the usual shiny object retail deals, unanchored strip malls than there's ever been ever. There's a group that has to deploy between $3 and $5 billion in the next 3 years into unanchored strips. There's another group that is acting on behalf of the state of North Carolina's pension. I think it's their pension fund. They've got $250 million of cash that they have to lever and deploy into unanchored strips and just unanchored strips. And then that doesn't include the usual suspects that are, you know, from outside of this market that are buying these things. So all of the sudden, unanchored strip malls, well, we went to ICSC in December in New York, and usually everyone wants to talk about grocery anchored and power and all that other stuff. Even the big institutions want to talk about unanchored strip malls. And we're seeing groups like Phillips really Edison trying to buy unanchored strips. So they are actually, because they have to deploy so much money, and because to deploy $3 billion with, you know, average price tag of $5 million, you've got to do an incredible amount of transactions. So they'll buy them cash. And really, you know, when you're buying deals at a sub-7 cap, today's debt, it doesn't work. But if they can pay cash, and that's what they're doing. So right now, that is probably the most active group, except for there's not that much for them to buy.
Yeah, right.
So,
and it hasn't quite caught up yet on the pricing side, where like you're just starting to see it now, where like it's, you can pry a few loose, but generally speaking, you know, to the point we made earlier, you know, why, if a lot of sellers are looking at their rent roll saying like, why would I do anything? Fundamentally, I'm looking great.
Yeah.
My debt's set for a while. My rent roll looks great. I don't really need to do anything.
And I can't exchange.
And yeah, what am I going to do with the money if I sell?
Right.
So it's either pay the tax.
My clients are saying that to me all the time.
Yeah. It's hard for us to argue that one, because we're telling you it's worth a lot because there's nothing on the market. And now we got an offer and you can't do an exchange. But again, I think that changes when they're staring down refinances at 6.5%, or, you know, today's world, 7.25%. I think that's when that stuff starts to shake loose. But there, it's incredible how much money has been raised for unanchored strip malls. It's nuts.
Is anyone buying with and putting debt on the properties? I mean, are you still doing some deals that involve financing?
Yes. Last year we did some of the bigger stuff, and they're trading at, you know, a bit higher cap rates, but we did the Crossroads deal in Roseville, and then we did a grocery anchor deal up in Elk River, and those were $30 million and $20 million, and those both have debt. And yeah, I mean, if you can get debt to pencil, if it's, and some buyers are of the mindset right now that rates are coming down. It's inevitable. And so they're willing to take less of a return today just so they can get control of the deals. Cause there's this big thought that rent growth is going to go. It's almost like apartments and industrial, and everybody was paying crazy cap rates for that stuff. It was all based on rent growth. So everybody thinks rents are going to grow in retail. So they're willing to take a lower return today, even if they need to put debt on it, and then they'll refi it out in, you know, 2 years and hopefully rents go up. So there, it works, but it's less common.
Interesting. Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, interesting strategy too, right? So just there's always opportunity in every market. It's just how to, you know, how to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, we have a lot of listings and they just, you know, it's just tough. What are the IPX numbers?
Oh yeah.
This is interesting stat
from, I mean, just like looking at like the buyer pool and talking about exchange buyers out there, the JLL, somebody was tracking the amount of funds sitting at an intermediary, like a national 1031 intermediary. Oh,
really? Yeah, that makes sense.
Good kind of litmus test for where the market's
absolutely
at, you know, and how much money you're sitting on. Well, the numbers we heard were in April of 22, which was like April or May of 22 was like the peak. And I think they were sitting on $10.5 billion of intermediary funds.
Wow.
And in the fall of 23, they were sitting on $4 to $4.5 billion.
Wow.
And the caveat there, the asterisk on that was, and we're finding that of the $4.5 billion or $4 billion, half the people are just paying the gains.
Interesting.
So like, you know, whereas
nothing out there
in early 22, everybody was like, you know, intermediary funds would come in, you execute the exchange and they're gone. Well, it means the 1031 market is down 70%, you know, roughly.
Wow.
And you can see that in all the net lease inventory that we're working on. You know, you can see it in the offers where you just have, like I said, you see less 1031 buyers actually putting the offers in. So
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, there's opportunity in that as well, maybe. So mm-hmm.
Totally.
Yeah. Well, you guys, I really appreciate your taking the time to kind of make us smarter.
I don't know if we did that.
Hopefully a little bit.
I feel a little smarter. I'm sure everybody feels a little smarter. It's just really impressive to talk to people that are really focused on something and know it so well. And so for you to know the retail capital market so well and share that information with us, it's fun. And it's fun to hang with you guys as well.
Appreciate you having us.
Yeah, thank you.
I hope
I'm not here 18 years from now to do it again.
well, you might
maybe
be here.
Maybe the ownership
we'll
side.
We'll be talking about something totally different then for sure. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, all right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of People, Places, and How We Use Spaces. I am business owner, broker, commercial real estate investor, and your host, Lisa Christensen. If you like this episode, please subscribe, share, and leave a review. To connect with me or the guests on today's show, shoot me an email at lisa@christensenandco.com. That's lisa@christensen.com. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.